Good morning. My name is Peter Valente. I'm with the East-West Center, and I'm very thankful and honored to be the recipient of the Ricardo Salinas Foundation scholarship for the ASF this year. I'm delighted to present this session, particularly as somebody who works in U.S.-Asia relations, because we've all heard a lot about Russia over the past couple of days, particularly how they relate to our national security. But I think something that's going to be one of the biggest issues over the next couple of decades is the U.S.-China relationship. And there may actually be no bigger, more important geostrategic relationship in the decades to come. The panel's called That Was Then. The president's tough talk on China during the campaign has given way to a budding bromance with Xi Jinping. Will the mutual charm offensive last? And if so, what are its implications for resolving the threats from North Korea, the buildup in the South China Sea, and cyber espionage? Moderating this session is Michael Crowley. Michael Crowley is a senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, covering foreign policy and national security from Washington. Prior to joining Politico in 2014, Crowley was chief foreign affairs correspondent for Time. His work has been featured in Best American Political Writing, and he is a regular commentator on television and radio. So please welcome Michael Crowley.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Let me introduce the panel, and then we're going to try something a little unconventional. Hopefully it works. If not, I won't be back next year. To my right is the Ambassador of Japan to the U.S., Kenichiro Sasai. Thank you so much for joining us, Ambassador. Bonnie Glazer is Senior Advisor for Asia and Director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And at the end, we're so fortunate to be joined by Michael Collins, Deputy Assistant Director at the East Asia Mission Center of the Central Intelligence Agency. So your analysis will be fascinating, Michael. I thought there have been a lot of panels, and it's Saturday morning. It's a little bit gray. We would try something a little different, a brief video clip to sort of set the stage. And if it doesn't work, we're not sure we have the AV nailed. We'll dive right in. But can we please try to play the clip now?
Let's say China. China, China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China,
China. You go over to China, China
during the campaign.
China, China,
China,
China, China,
China,
China, China. I love them. China,
China,
China, China,
China.
I have to have my China.
China,
China, because China,
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 China.
You know, China.
I know China very well. China,
China,
China.
China,
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 China.
Northwest Wisconsin.
Okay. That actually goes on for another 2 minutes. Thank you to the panel for indulging it. They don't necessarily endorse the video. A year ago at this time, or when Donald Trump, for much of Donald Trump's campaign for president, the hot topic, of course, was not Russia, particularly in terms of Trump's own rhetoric. And it was China that he talked about constantly when we talked about international affairs. And you know, I think as we heard in the introduction, this conference is a reminder of the degree to which Russia has drowned out our strategic competition slash partnership with China, which I think we can make a good case over the long term is the larger issue, and we're going to talk about that. I just want to briefly remind people a little bit more of some of the things Trump said, remind us of the contrast between the campaign and today. During that campaign, Donald Trump said that China is raping America economically, that in the South China Sea, China had built a military fortress the likes of which perhaps the world has not seen, said that China has no respect for our country, threatened to declare Beijing a currency manipulator, after his election, appeared as though he may not honor the longtime One China policy. And Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, in his confirmation hearings, spoke extremely hawkishly about U.S. policy in the South China Sea, leading some people to think we would be headed for an early confrontation. Since then, we've seen a rather different tone, of course, I think most notably at the Chummy Summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago in April, characterized by the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake you've ever seen, as Trump put it, and U.S. missile strikes in Syria, and we can revisit that. It's not what we might have expected, but let's first, before we talk about this, you might even call it a bromance, which is the word used in the setup for our panel. But before we get to the question of this bromance, let's set the stage. And Michael, I want to go to you first. And can you talk about China versus Russia as a strategic challenge for the United States? Are we kind of missing the real point here with all our fixation on Russia?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you to the Institute for the invitation to talk about this really important conversation. And to echo what General Hayden said yesterday about this relationship, in my view, I may be biased, given where I sit in CIA, is arguably the most strategically consequential relationship for the United States and the larger international order, I would suggest. And not just 20 years from now, today. So, yeah, there's been a lot of talk about Russia as a competitor, a country that sees the liberal international order as something they don't necessarily subscribe to, that is actively engaged in trying to undermine U.S. influence in various areas around the world, and that has capability to do it. I would argue China applies to all three of those as well, and increasingly has more power to do far more about that issue. And so when we think about the nature and the extent of not just what's happening in East Asia and what China's trying to achieve in East Asia, but more fundamentally, what the impact of China's rise means for the stability and the endurance of the international-led, the order that that has brought about peace and stability for the last 30, 40 years. I think we need to take more seriously what it means to think about China and its goals and aspirations. I think if we're successful here, we will have left all of you, this esteemed collective, a stronger appreciation for this challenge, what it means for the United States, and importantly, the role of our partnership with academia, with all parts across the government, with foreign partners as to what to do in response to this issue. The nature of the question here on this relationship, from the Chinese perspective, the relationship is inherently competitive. They view what they're trying to achieve in East Asia, and I would argue increasingly more so overseas, in competitive terms with the United States. They have a different view of governance and what that means, and they are increasingly resorting to coercive, assertive practices to achieve their ends, things that we don't subscribe to and others in the region don't subscribe to. And for that reason, for us to understand issues such as North Korea, South China Sea, trade, how China's approaching these issues, we have to be mindful of that. Now, that doesn't mean the relationship is inherently on a course to lead to war. I know Graham Allison's book has been getting a lot of coverage on this, that to the Chinese, they also do not want a conflictual relationship with the United States and the international community. They do not want backlash in East Asia. And they need a stable, robust relationship with the United States and the international community for the economic needs and the technology they need to move their country forward. At the end of the day, too, as much as I talk a lot about Chinese international aspirations, we have to be mindful about what they face internally. As much as they are trying to acquire something we already have in terms of U.S. influence and leadership, they also have something we don't have, which is a domestic political vulnerability and stability. And to them, they have to keep that quite secure. And to that end, they need stability and close relations and stable relations with the United States.
So let's come back to domestic politics, which is an important point. Bonnie, maybe you can pick up on that theme of whether or not there is some inevitable path to confrontation. Michael mentioned Graham Allison's book, which I think Graham Allison will be familiar to many people in this room. Those of you who may not know, he's written a book arguing that based on Greek history and the Peloponnesian War and the writings of Thucydides, an historical theory that says that a rising power and an established power will sort of by default fall into conflict, although not inevitably. The U.S. and China may be on a collision course. I actually wrote about this for Politico. Graham was invited to come speak to the National Security Council about this theory, so it's actually got some traction. I don't know whether or not they agree with it. But Bonnie, what do you think about that? Can you talk about this school of thought that there is an inevitable path of confrontation between the U.S. and China right now? We don't have to get into the Greek history. Don't worry about that.
I was going to start by saying that classicists, I think, are debating whether or not Graham Allison has correctly interpreted Thucydides. It is an important question as to whether or not the United States and China are headed for conflict. I want to agree with Michael that China is not seeking military conflict with the United States. Tension and friction, Xi Jinping is quite comfortable with, and in some ways may have even an appetite for greater friction and tension, and not just with the United States, but with also countries on China's periphery. But a military conflict is not something that China seeks, and we see when the United States conducts freedom of navigation operations, for example, in the South China Sea, that the Chinese respond perhaps rhetorically tough. But when they're moving around their military assets, they are doing so in a cautious way. Yes, I think that the path to military conflict exists. It is certainly not inevitable. And even Professor Allison does not argue that military conflict is inevitable. I am concerned about the potential for miscalculation, that the Chinese might see that the Trump administration is distracted, perhaps devoting less attention to Asia, giving China a lot of running room. We have seen, for example, with the U.S. withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Paris Climate Change Agreement, I think that this has given the Chinese more opportunity to step up and try and work the international system in a way that is to their advantage. And I would say that if the Chinese were here today or they watch these panels, that they probably would conclude that the focus on Middle East, ISIS, terrorism, Russia, all of these things very much work to China's advantage. The Chinese have been very, they've seen great benefit in the past when the U.S. has been otherwise distracted. And the fact that we now say the rebalance or pivot to Asia is basically over. We haven't really replaced it with anything. We are not out front and center promoting American values in the region. We are certainly working very closely with our allies, but the Chinese at the same time are working to divide and weaken those alliances. So the potential for, I think, miscalculation is real. Whether or not there's a potential, you know, maybe 10 years out, for a sort of global conflict, the situation is going to change over time. I think right now the greatest tensions between the U.S. and China are in Asia. China's priorities are in Asia. They are trying to organize the regions in a way that it is more Sino-centric, where China can prevail and can essentially compel other countries in the region to put China's interests first and show deference to China. And that is a major challenge for the United States. And I would close by saying that we have to think about China not just in terms of discrete issues like North Korea or cyber, as we have talked about at this conference, but really as a more of a global challenge, and we need more of a whole-of-government strategy to deal with the growing strategic competition between the United States and China. The competition is inevitable. War is not.
Thank you. And we can talk more about solutions in a few minutes. Ambassador, give us the view from your part of the world. Obviously, Japan has a particular interest in Chinese power, Chinese claims. Do you think that the United States fully appreciates the nature of rising Chinese power in the region? Do you feel, I've spoken to some people from Japanese government and politics who think that we're not quite sufficiently awake to the Chinese threat. How do you see the debate in Washington? Does it reflect what you're seeing in the region?
Well, I came to the United States roughly 5 years ago. I think the people's interest in Asia was growing little by little, partly because of Chinese more assertive actions in South China Sea and East China Sea, and rapid expansions of their military infrastructure build-up, and all this Chinese global outreach, whether it is predatory taking of resources from the developing countries or assistance program, which is not really consistent to developed countries' standards and so forth. So what China has been doing is getting more of the attention, that is true. But as a result of especially on the South China Sea. I think there is more attention given to the possible intention of China. Well, that I agree with Bonnie that China is not really seeking the war with the United States. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is also true they would like to see the United States withdrawing so that they have more space to operate their influence and influence the development of the regional strategic pictures. And so for that, I think we continue to develop some of the alliance network and network of friends, including ASEAN, ALOK, and Australia, New Zealand, and also India these days. I think Chinese ambition is not simply limited to try to equal with United States in the area of Asia Pacific, but goes beyond that. If you look at the, you know, in the China Sea, and you know, even to Africa, I think their outreach is enormous these days. That is not simply for the economic ambition; it's more of the strategic ambition. They want to be a big country to compete with the United States. That's what their ambition is all about.
Let's stay on the South China Sea for a minute, because that seems to be arguably the real friction point, most dangerous aspect of the relationship right now. I want to offer another alarmist quote. This is senior White House advisor Steve Bannon. Before he was part of the Trump campaign, on his radio show in March 2016, Bannon, I would remind you, was a sailor in the Pacific Fleet, I think, 20-plus years ago, invoking his Navy service, said, "I was a sailor there in the South China Sea. We're going to war in the South China Sea in 5 to 10 years, aren't we? There's no doubt about that." Bonnie, why don't I throw this to you? And, you know, you did touch on the fact that conflict is not inevitable, but can you just drill down a little bit on how things are playing out in the South China Sea since Donald Trump's inauguration? And one more quote, Rex Tillerson in his inaugural confirmation hearing: "We're going to have to send China a clear signal that first, the island building stops, and second, your access to those islands also is not going to be allowed." He's referring, of course, to the essentially man-made islands that China has built up in the last couple years and established military footholds on. How has that played out in the last 6 months? Why don't you focus more on Tillerson's comment and the degree to which the Trump administration has or has not backed that up?
Well, Secretary Tillerson, of course, made that comment during his confirmation hearings, not once he was Secretary of State. And the activity in the South China Sea, the island building, where there are 7 artificial islands that are now military outposts in the Spratlys, this, of course, took place during the Obama administration. And there was, I think, somewhat of a failure during the Obama administration to completely understand what the Chinese were engaged in. Happened very rapidly, and we now see that the Chinese have virtually completed what they are building. And we see 3 islands, for example, that each have 24 hardened aircraft shelters. It is only a matter of time before the Chinese start using those military outposts, landing military aircraft and other military assets. They have radar. They have more effective maritime domain awareness than they have ever had over the entire South China Sea. So the question is, what is the Trump administration going to do about it? And the statement by Tillerson that we would deny China access to these islands, I think, if we carry that out as policy, could potentially lead to war, frankly. The Chinese claim sovereignty, and U.S. position is not to question or challenge Chinese sovereignty or anybody's sovereignty over these islands, with the exception of one that is on the continental shelf of the Philippines and was found by an arbitral tribunal under UNCLOS to be part of the Philippines continental shelf. So that is a separate question. And the Trump administration, to give them credit, in their first freedom of navigation operation, did challenge that sovereignty around Mr. Freeth. And so I do give them credit for that. But the bigger question is, how do we prevent the Chinese from increasing their control over the South China Sea, using these islands to coerce their neighbors, which they do on a daily basis through fishing, interfering with other countries, energy exploitation, Coast Guard operations, And this is an area where I do see the Trump administration stepping up. We've gone apparently from about 700 ship days in the South China Sea last year. We are on track, I understand, for 900 this year. We are doing a lot more exercises with our partners, including Japan, where we just conducted an operation in the South China Sea a few weeks ago. But this is a huge challenge. Because if we are going to actually take the Chinese on in terms of their sovereignty and their operations, then we are going to have to accept a degree of risk that we have been unwilling to do so in the past.
Mike, can you talk about how the Chinese are watching this, watching the increased tempo that Bonnie just described, and give us just a little bit of a sense of how they think about the South China Sea and America's presence in it?
Yeah, I think it's critical. When I asked my analysts to assess China's view of any issue in confrontation with the United States or any country, frankly, there's three aspects of that that really matter. What's their overall intent? What capability do they have to do something about it? And increasingly, it's this third component, what I call resolve or fortitude, that is probably most important to gauging China's readiness or the proximate likelihood of some degree of conflict or them moving forward. We know broadly they have aspirations to establish dominion in the South China Sea for various reasons, for military, economic, political influence purposes. It's one thing for those things to be aspirational and another for them to think they're actually attainable. And increasingly, it appears to us that the Chinese think what they're moving forward in the South China Sea, and you can apply this elsewhere as well, are increasingly attainable. It's not just because of the capabilities, which is this next component, but it's in that third area, what I call resolve. Unfortunately, I think the Chinese have learned over the last several years that they have been able to take coercive approaches to moving into the South China Sea. And in other areas, I could apply the same model to other issues, be it in the economic arena or the political arena around the area. And they've gotten away with it without much of a blowback. The UNCLOS ruling that Bonnie refers to, they learned from that, in our view, that they can defy international law and get away with it. And so on that last component, the extent to which, on that resolve area, the Chinese continue to think that they can get away with and push the envelope on coercive, more assertive approaches to doing this, we worry they will continue to push that envelope. I would also add to that, though, a domestic political component, which in some cases I'm more worried about as it informs resolve. It's what's happening internally within China. It's the narrative within China that they are promulgating a view that this is something that the Chinese need to achieve. They've taken a more expansive view of what they call core interests. You know, core interests used to be about the Communist Party and Taiwan. Increasingly, they're expanding that definition. And in doing so, they're creating domestic expectations that I worry they're going to have to try to respond to and in difficult ways. So I hope that framework allows us to think through when you think in that resolve component. There's not much we can do about intention. They will always have these aspirations. They will continue to acquire the capabilities. There's not much there we can stop. It's in that third component that I would argue the solution probably lies.
You think it's fair to say there's a kind of game of chicken going on where each side is testing to see where the other's red line is? And
well, I'll speak for the China side. Yeah, very much. Yeah. The Chinese are learning, I'd call it a didactic foreign policy, didactic approach to learning what it is they can get away with. My hope is that the Chinese increasingly start to see that their behavior, and not just from us, but from East Asia, is actually creating more negative consequences, net negative outcomes for their security interests and overall stability mm-hmm. than the positive they think it gets them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's an ongoing, I think, and we have to watch not just what we're learning about their behavior, but increasing how they're learning what it is they can accomplish and what they're learning from us and from the rest of the region in terms of our response.
Ambassador, yeah. If I let me just set you up and you can say whatever you're going to say, but the South China Sea is not the only flashpoint, and you, of course, have a particular interest in the East China Sea, and I think, correct me if I'm mistaken, when we talk about the East China Sea, we're focusing primarily on the disputed Senkaku Islands, which Japan has control of. China does not recognize that Japanese control. Japan, a couple years ago, established a air zone. What's the phrase for it?
Air defense identification zone, which China has
established.
Thank you. Jim Mattis, Defense Secretary, said in February that the U.S. Defense alliance with Japan does extend to the defense of these islands. And many of sort of Graham Allisons of the world see in these islands a potential flashpoint that could produce a larger conflict, partly as a result of entangling alliances, the stated United States obligation. So can you talk to me about what you think the risk level is there? Mm-hmm. Seems like it got very dangerous a few years ago and has settled down a bit and fallen out of the headlines. But give us a sense now of how tense things are, and give us a little bit of a feel of the Chinese presence. I gather they are testing the airspace, sending military aircraft into the region. What is the possibility for an accident or a miscalculation?
Well, before coming to Senkaku and East China Sea, I want to say a bit about South China Sea.
Please.
You know, people tend to think that this happened just over 5 or 6, 7 year time frame. But I think what happened is that this was designed throughout 3 or 4 decades from Chinese point of view. I think they have been doing this with specific strategic design to expand, sort of creeping expansion one by one. And I think a fourth round of the expansion is more or less over. I mean, they establish all this, you know, military base on the island and so forth. And the question is that are we willing to push this back or just admit this as a new normal? I think that's a very difficult question, because if you think that this will be the continuation of the next round of expansions beyond the second change of island moving into Western Pacific, then you have to think three times, what would you do? And that's the question, the very much a strategic question. That does not necessarily mean that you have to confront China in the military conflict, but that's more related to day-to-day, you know, expressions of your political and strategic world. Now, how you will deal with all this creeping expansion and going from creeping to more visible expansions, and military expansion. And that is not simply, meaning to the United States. All the countries around the China, especially the ASEAN countries, are looking at all this attitude of the United States, how the United States would react to this one. If they believe that the United States is just trying to simply maintain the status quo, this is already not a status quo anymore. But they might think that the United States might be simply watching and backing off. Then they might be willing to deal with China. I mean, because they have to serve the purpose of making good friendship with China and the United States. They don't want to get involved with any military conflict between the two giants. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be some strategic design, you know, to be more sort of visible, not only diplomatic channel, but also to the wider audience in Asia Pacific. That's what I just want to say.
Sure.
And number two is that what's happening in South China Sea is not irrelevant to what's happening in East China Sea. These are coming from the same ambitions of China, one way or another. And they like to expand the their sphere of influence. And the best way is to make sure that they would like to maintain their the assertions about the sovereignty issues, whether it is South China Sea or East China Sea. We ourselves believe that this has never been part of China throughout the history. You just imagine that a country like Cuba and others come to some place around Florida and claim that the small island off the coast of Florida is theirs. And can you define that's a dispute? You don't believe that way. So, this island, small island, you might think that this is not something great. But as I said, this is a case to test a nerve.
Well, can I just jump in, Ambassador, and make this a little more vivid for people, and then we'll move on because there's so much to cover. But I believe it was NBC that reported in the last several weeks, Japan is now averaging roughly 2 intercepts of Chinese aircraft per day since April of last year, nearly twice as many in the 12 months prior. In response to the uptick in Chinese military activity in that airspace, that Japan considers its responsibility. That sounds dangerous.
It is, I think.
How do you limit the risk there?
Yeah, as you said it, the level of Chinese flying over to us is more or less equaling to what the Soviet Union during the Cold War were doing around our airspace. And So to most of the Americans, Russia continues to be a major preoccupation and possibly a strategic threat. But to most Japanese, I think Russian threat is basically Cold War threat, although it is happening in the context of East-West in Ukraine, other global competition. But to most Japanese, I think a threat is on the rise from China. And we don't define Chinese expansion as a direct threat yet. Mm-hmm, we still want to see Chinese rise as a peaceful rise. Okay. And so that's why I think we want to have more established mechanisms of crisis management. Actually, we have been proposing this crisis management dialogue mechanism with Chinese government. We have been doing for more than 5, 6, 7 years since the time when I was in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. We proposed. They said it's fine, but there is some discussion on the way. They stop and prolong the dialogue, and they don't come back, stop and go, all this process. And, that's the same as what's happening in the discussions on the code of conduct issues in South China Sea. Yeah. They say that they do have a dialogue. They have a constructive dialogue. Let's do and wait, don't meddle with on bilateral affairs. But so that also the issue to us. But when it comes to sovereignty, there is no issue for us to address.
Okay, so that's a red line for you.
Yeah.
Let's go to this question of the relationship between the two leaders. That was part of the description of this panel, and then I want to spend a little bit of time on North Korea because it's so central, and we are going to take questions from you all soon. Bonnie, maybe you can talk about how the Chinese leadership sees Donald Trump right now. I mean, give us some understanding of what they make of the guy. We set the table with these quotes from the campaign, which were so incendiary. We've seen a very different style since Trump came into office. There was this very chummy summit at Mar-a-Lago in April. Seems like the tone might be darkening a little bit more recently. There was a frosty meeting on economics in Washington this past week, it appears. But give us your sense of how the Chinese leadership sees Donald Trump right now and sort of how they're playing the relationship.
Well, China's view of the United States under the Trump administration has evolved and I think is continuing to evolve. During the campaign, when Donald Trump was criticizing China on trade issues, Beijing was quite concerned about very high-level tariffs, for example, on Chinese goods. And I think that they were quite pleased when Donald Trump decided that North Korea would be the focus, the priority of the bilateral relationship, even to the extent that the president said he would give China a good deal on trade if it cooperated on North Korea. The Chinese, as we will, I'm sure, hear more in the next panel, but they have been masterful in trying to do the minimum, I think, to satisfy the United States on North Korea, getting credit for it, but really not stepping up and, for example, shutting down the banks, the fund companies that operate in Northeast China that enable North Korea to conduct illicit activities. So when Trump invited Xi Jinping to Mar-a-Lago, this was a great opportunity for Xi Jinping to further sort of shape this relationship. I give Trump some credit for setting priorities in the relationship. I mean, you can't just ask the Chinese for 10 things and expect them to deliver on all of them. But I do think that you can't just say North Korea is going to be the really only thing that matters. So the Chinese have gotten, I think, some things out of Trump, but they see him as unpredictable. They are worried, for example, even continuing today, about what he might do on Taiwan. As early on, there was a phone call between President Trump before he was inaugurated.
Remind people, breaking how many years of precedence?
It's not how many years of precedence. It was completely unprecedented.
Right,
we have never had a sitting president who has had a telephone call with Taiwan's president.
But subsequently, just to close the loop on that, Trump reaffirmed the One-China policy.
Trump reaffirmed the One-China policy because Xi Jinping said there would be no diplomatic interaction or cooperation with the United States on any issue until he reaffirmed the One-China policy. And so I see that the Chinese are generally comfortable with dealing with the Trump administration, but continue to be worried about that unpredictability that he might do something that they don't expect.
Very quickly, and I want to get to you, Michael. How significant was that moment? I mean, did the Chinese, do you think they interpreted that as Donald Trump being willing to back down when they signaled that he was nearing a red line? I mean, do you think that that defined their early understanding of Donald? I feel like we already forget some of these things that have happened because the early Trump administration has been so chaotic. That was a really important moment, it seems to me. Do you think for them that was a defining moment?
I think for the Chinese, they understand how to convey to the United States that when something is their absolute bottom line that they will not compromise on, that they can do that effectively. They did it. They got what they wanted from Donald Trump. And I think that they did draw lessons from it, but I don't think that they believe that they can do that effectively on every issue going forward.
Mike, I don't expect from your perch to be able to analyze the so-called bromance, per se, but as somebody who analyzes China so carefully, what insights can you give us about how they perceive the United States at this moment in time, the Trump administration specifically, the last 6 months? Any lessons you think the Chinese might be learning or revealing actions the Chinese have taken in response to statements and policy of the Trump administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a critical period right now in helping to influence China's perception of the United States. And I say, again, getting back to my point earlier about their sense of, when I say their resolve, also critical is their perception of U.S. resolve. They feed off one another, and as much as the Chinese leadership expects and sees a degree of tension in the U.S.-China relationship, because there are differences at the strategic level, key to them is their perception of how much tension is the United States willing to accept in the relationship, and the extent to which, in their view, the U.S. may be willing to go further in that area of tension to accomplish something. Or do they perceive that the United States would back down if faced with tension to avoid it? I think we're in this period right now where, to Bonnie's point, I think the Chinese are trying to figure out the administration and trying to figure out where are those areas where this administration may be willing to accept more attention and what areas perhaps not. And I think we'll see this play out and they'll put the pieces, they'll put the pieces together looking at where we are in the economic relationship, where we are in the North Korea relationship. Where are we on some of these other issues that they're going to try to figure out? Where are we willing to, go firm? North Korea, obviously. Where are we willing to go firm, and where are we willing, perhaps, to fall back? So I think they're in that critical period right now of learning what it is that this administration, and not just our willingness to accept some degree of tension, but that as well with our partners. I say this is increasingly important for them to think not just in terms of the United States, but what we're doing and interacting with our key allies and partners in the Asia.
By the way, you mentioned North Korea. We'll come to it in a minute. We're going a little light on it because the next panel will be dedicated to North Korea. But let me follow up with you, Michael, quickly on the internal political question. The Trump administration has deprioritized democracy promotion and human rights, and it seems not to be a central part of arguably was not a central part of Barack Obama's agenda either, but it seemed to be a diminished part of the Trump administration's agenda. Whether or not you want to comment specifically on Trump policy, could you just talk about what impact removing or shrinking those issues in the U.S.-China dialogue would be likely to have in Beijing? I mean, how do the Chinese feel about, how have they felt historically about these issues being raised? What role have they played in the larger relationship, and how might the relationship change as a result?
I would say from China's optic, as I said earlier, opening up, the Chinese do have a different view of governance. What's important to their view of the stability of their government, and how do they maintain the loyalty of the Chinese people, to the Communist Party. And so to them, things like democracy and human rights and rule of law, of course, are challenges to that end. And the extent to which those are no longer seen as important in not just our narrative, but the international narrative and the regional narrative, is something that does give them a degree of assurance.
Mm-hmm.
And it also affects and influences China's relations with others, not just in Asia, but around the world. That is the extent to which that they feel they can accomplish something with that other country, because to them, human rights, rule of law, democracy aren't as important. So they're no longer as brakes on what it is perhaps the Chinese may be able to achieve with a partner of ours that perhaps they think we can't achieve because of those standards. So, they factor very seriously into their view of how the U.S. approaches China, but also to the extent this informs the larger narrative of U.S. priorities around the world, what it is they can get away with or work with on other countries with whom they are trying to dilute U.S. influence.
So signaling a little bit about how the U.S. is going to... we're setting a tone for international behavior that doesn't, that goes beyond the bilateral relationship. Ambassador, one more, and we'll, a little more specifically on the relationship. And you have an interesting perspective because your leader had an amazing visit with Donald Trump. I think it was the first foreign leader visit. Mr. Abe flew down to Florida on Air Force One. I heard a former National Security Council official say he understood that was only the fourth foreign leader in the history of Air Force One to fly on that plane. The two men played nearly 30 rounds of golf and had a great time. So we wonder how the Chinese watched all this. No doubt this was great news for Japan. Do you want to talk about that relationship briefly? But then what do you see in terms of the Trump-Xi relationship, the Xi's visit to Mar-a-Lago? What kind of relationship do you observe forming there? And is it competitive?
Yeah, well, I think that's a healthy competition, possibly, rather than competing militarily and others.
On the golf, we'll take it, we'll settle it on the golf course.
Yeah. I think we had a great time in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, I wasn't playing.
Were you there?
No, I was there, but yeah. I wasn't playing. I mean, I was just goofing off while they were playing. But, you know.
How's the food?
Yeah, the food was great.
Yeah, okay.
And Mar-a-Lago itself, I have been there before with my wife, a Red Cross event, so without knowing that that was run by Mr. Trump, but it was fun. I think Prime Minister had a good talk with the president and the millennial and the family and so forth. So, whatever the relationship might be, I think the relationship between the heads of the state, I mean, leaders, need to be good. Mm-hmm. And that is a basis. And then they could discuss on the policy. I mean, of course, there are different kinds of positions, even difference. But when there is some basic understanding, even say some confidence, and that is essential part of what you need to work on.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm just mindful of the time. Do you see that early confidence in the Trump-Xi relationship? But just give us a quick analysis of it.
Right. I think that's continuous. I mean, they make a telephone calls quite often. Some of them are not necessarily made public. They have confidential conversation and going back and forth. They have some letters exchanged and so forth. So in terms of a level of conversations and frequency of conversations, I think it's very good. It doesn't mean that we have agreement on every issue. For example, when it comes to trade and how you deal with TPP, for example, mm-hmm. we continue to believe that TPP is a good strategic instrument. Mm-hmm. I don't say to counter Chinese expansions in the region, but it's more so in terms of making America's strategic presence felt by the region. So I think that needs to be understood, and that's continued to be on our agenda.
I have to put you on the spot a little bit because you're here. Does Mrs. Abe speak English?
Yeah.
And does everyone here know why I'm asking?
Yes. I think she does.
Can you help us understand why Donald Trump said he didn't
know.
Talk to
I don't
her at
know.
The G20
I wasn't in the meeting. Possibly I was the interpreter.
Uh-huh.
I think she was using interpreter.
Uh-huh.
And
just for those who don't know, Donald Trump said he didn't speak to Mrs. Abe at the G20 dinner because she didn't speak English, not even hello.
Yeah.
And you can go online and find video of her speaking pretty decent English.
But I think at the same time, he said that he had a very interesting and lovely time with Mrs. Abe. So you have to put
just
this all together. I don't want to get reactive with every statement the president made on this.
Fair enough. I had to ask.
Can I jump in on Xi Jinping?
Yes, please. And then we'll do North Korea for a couple minutes, and we'll go to your questions.
Great. I just don't think that any panel on China would really be complete unless we do say something about China's leader, Xi Jinping. We are heading towards a 19th Party Congress this fall, which will mark the end of the first five-year term and then the beginning of the second. Xi Jinping is an extraordinarily powerful leader. And, of course, his goals are to rejuvenate the Communist Party and the Chinese nation. And what we see is a lot of jockeying for power currently now, just in the news this past week. Xi Jinping did take down the party secretary of Chongqing, who has now been charged with some unclear wrongdoings. But another example of how the anti-corruption campaign is being used in China really for political purposes. And so I know we've all had a lot of discussion about Putin and the role that he plays in Russia. And I don't want to draw any specific comparisons, but the role of the leader in China is extremely important. This is a man who has called himself the core leader. His predecessor, Hu Jintao, was not the core leader of the party. Jiang Zemin was the prior core leader. And the going forward, I mean, he has already taken charge of so many of the decision-making mechanisms in China. But I think increasingly going forward that he will be the decisive person who is making decisions on a range of issues that will affect the domestic environment in China as well as foreign policy decision making. And this is something that the United States should not underestimate.
Mike, give us a real quick take on that, and then we'll go to North Korea for a couple minutes.
And I would add to that, too, if he, as it looks like he's going to come out of this party Congress, all the more powerful that... As I said earlier, it appears the Chinese increasingly look at their aspirations as increasingly attainable. I say it's one thing if they're just aspirations, it's another actually if they think they're attainable. Obviously, from our standpoint, to the extent they undercut U.S. interests and U.S. Influence. But Xi is as she said, a key independent variable in this equation, and he may come out of this Congress all the more emboldened and empowered.
Is it possible that he would serve beyond the traditional 2 5-year terms and we're looking at a Putin or Erdogan kind of situation in terms of longevity and power?
It's possible that they can find a way to extend his term. He's going to have to retire as he reaches the required age. But Bonnie made this point yesterday in our conversation that regardless of what position he's in, given the allegiances he's established, that he's going to remain probably pretty influential.
Who was president of the chess club?
It was Deng Xiaoping, who is actually, his title was the honorary chairman of the Bridge Club, even though he was, of course, the most powerful and prominent leader in China.
So it's a little absurd to do North Korea quickly, but again, you all can enjoy the next panel, which is going to be great and has fantastic people on it. But let's do it for a couple minutes in the context specifically of this bilateral relationship. Michael, do you want to just kind of frame it for us, talk about how the Chinese see this issue in the context of relations with the United States, and what are their equities here that they're trying to protect as Donald Trump is trying so hard to stop the North's missile program, nuclear and missile programs?
Yeah, on the one hand, they recognize this is an important issue for the United States, and they are trying to find a way to show that they're taking a cooperative approach. All of us can probably agree they could be doing a lot more. They do account for 90% of North Korean trade. They also know just more generally that when they think of the overall health of the U.S.-China relationship, to the extent that they can be seen as helpful in North Korea, maybe this helps them in other areas. And they do worry about North Korea as a nuclear state. They do, in their policy, want to see brought about the denuclearization of North Korea. Their timeline, however, is probably more extended than we would like. But really is core to the Chinese, and this gets back to how I opened up. To them, you have to understand their strategic situation and how they think of North Korea and its endurance for what China is more trying to achieve in East Asia as well as to avoid. And that's, certainly instability on their border. They're desperately concerned that any increased pressure on North Korea could lead to a destabilization that would affect China internally. But strategically, the point was made in a few venues here, the strategic buffer, the endurance of North Korea as a block between the U.S.-led alliance in South Korea and China is also pretty important to the Chinese. I think looking forward, if we were to see a more effective Chinese approach to pressuring North Korea, and whatever options we consider, all would agree the Chinese role is pretty critical, whether that's in the pressure standpoint or in supporting some other activity, that they would have to come out, they have to start to realize that what North Korea is generating, North Korea's WMD threat, is the reason so many things else are happening in East Asia. Whether that's THAAD in South Korea, whether that's enhancement of U.S. alliance ties in East Asia, that North Korea, because of its behavior and its threat, is creating more problems for China in East Asia from a security standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, that hopefully at some point they come to realize that's more worrisome to them than the risk of instability on the
Well, and maybe also economic problems. It seems plausible that the next stage, the next steps in Trump administration policy will be secondary sanctions against Chinese financial institutions. We've already seen a little bit of that. Seemed like a relatively muted Chinese response. But does anyone feel like they have a good sense of how Beijing is likely to respond if we start getting pretty serious with secondary sanctions, how much damage that does to the bilateral relationship? Michael, Bonnie, Ambassador, anybody feel like they have a good...
Yeah. I think that's what's exactly happening. As you know, we have been expecting China play a more greater role to place a pressure upon North Korea. That has been underway even from the previous government. I think after the President Trump came in, I think there was this pressure politics and policies now in the forefront. And that's what's happening. And UN Security Council resolution is one thing, but was that sufficient? I think obviously after UN Security Council resolution, there was another several missile shot. So it's not working as a deterrence, right. Sufficient pressure. So that's what I think this Trump administration is trying to supplement by its own unilateral action, which is targeting Chinese company as a secondary sanction. I think this pathway, hopefully, will be strengthened in the coming months. But in the meantime, you have to also think that even though all this pressure, North Korea might still go for testing, missile shooting, even for testing nuclear weapons and so forth. So I think the question arises, what will be the next phase if they don't come around, in terms of joint pressure?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to go to Bonnie real quick, and then we'll go to questions right now.
Just briefly, I think that the Chinese became comfortable in the Obama administration. There was a priority put, for example, on Chinese cooperation in the Iran deal and the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and an unwillingness to really challenge China, especially on this issue. There was no sanctioning of Chinese banks during the Obama administration. We did see a couple of weeks ago that the Trump administration has now, for the first time, it's under Section 311, sanctioned the Bank of Dandong, and you ask how the Chinese will respond. And I believe that this goes back to what Michael said earlier, that the Chinese will then see that the United States is willing to put at risk the U.S.-China relationship, and therefore I believe that they will adjust to that in a way where they will have to see that cooperation in North Korea, they have to do more. Now, that doesn't mean that they will do everything that the Trump administration wants. Big question is whether they will cut crude oil exports to North Korea. And this is something that's already right now under discussion up at the UN. But we can get the Chinese to do more. They will not meet what we want them to do. Chinese cooperation is necessary, but it is not sufficient. And I know the next panel is really going to talk about what our broader policy should be.
Thank you. Questions, please. Who has a question right there? Is that Karen? Hi.
Karen Brooks, Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to all for a great panel. The Chinese recently, about a week or so ago, deployed troops to the Republic of Djibouti, presaging what seems to be its first overseas base. I'd welcome the panel's view on what this means, what its implications are, and if, in fact, Xi Jinping is going to further consolidate power in the wake of the 19th Party Congress coming up, would we expect more expansionist military endeavors and perhaps even a more militant foreign policy? Thanks.
Who wants to grab that?
I can grab that. So yeah, I'm glad you raised that, the Djibouti deployment. When you look at, gets to my point I said earlier today, that it's not just an East Asia issue. East Asia is priority to the Chinese, but increasingly we're seeing the Chinese take a more expansive view of where they have interests and where they want to have presence and influence. And Djibouti is just one example of where they're looking to extend their military access, at least. OBOR, the One Belt, One Road initiative, is another example of where the Chinese are trying to expand their economic influence. And this is not just for influence, but also to deal with overcapacity inside of China and to deal with domestic problems there. But yeah, this is an example of when I say increasingly we have to be honest and realistic about where we're coming into conflict with the Chinese on various issues. These are examples. They want to establish a greater ability to influence the seas without having to rely or worry about the U.S. influence over the seas. And so that's an example of that. On the domestic front, I would just say it's not quite clear. After he does, it looks like, based on what we're seeing in terms of leaders being handpicked and not handpicked around him, that he is likely to come out of this more secure. And for what we've seen in his behavior from moving, as I said earlier, from the aspirational to the attainable, I do worry that we'll have a more confident and perhaps assertive policies coming out of them after the Party Congress.
Let's do one answer per question so we can get a bunch in back there. Unless you really have a fire under you.
Hi, Peter Valente with the East-West Center. Recently, Shinzo Abe has indicated in statements that there may be a possibility of being open to joining China-led initiatives like Belt and Road or AIIB. And while it may be a little bit far off right now, in light of the U.S. withdrawal from TPP, what do you think it would take for Japan to start to look at more China-led or China-inclusive initiatives like RCEP or anything like that?
Well, I think the Chinese initiative for AIIB or this One Road, One Belt initiative, to the extent that they are following the international norms, you know, sort of principles that we have been working, and as a developed country, that'll be fine, because there is obviously demand for infrastructure building in the region and beyond the region. So AIIB, if to the extent that that would be, possibly within the framework of what we could cooperate, why not? But in the meantime, there are other institutions like Asian Development Bank, Bank, and so forth. So to the extent that that would be complementary, that would be great. So there is no reason for us to say no to that. It's another matter whether you have money to spend for that. That's something else. But when it comes to one road, one belt initiative, again, you know, to the extent that that will be done with the transparencies, some of the rules in place, and done in a fair and open manner, and why not? That's what I think Prime Minister said it. But in the meantime, you have to also figure out what is the strategic motivation behind it. If that will come together with the military expansion to Indian Ocean and to the Middle East, then that will be connected with the development port facilities and others, and Chinese military has access to that. Then you have to think more closely to the implications of that. But I think coming back to a Chinese global exposition, I think that their dream, Chinese dream, is becoming global power. It is obvious. I think their dream is like the 12th and 13th century of Ming Dynasty, which reached over to Indian Ocean and into Middle East. I think that's the vision they might harbor deep into the mind.
Thank you, Ambassador. Right here. Quick questions and answers, please, so we can get in a few more.
Sure. Mark Mayberry, MITRE. 2015, the U.S. agreed to new agreement with China with respect to cyber norms. Subsequently, Germany and the U.K. also had bilateral agreements. And yet we've seen companies in my home state, one attack from Sinoville against American Superconductor, $800 million, 25,000 jobs. How are we doing in protecting our homeland, particularly our economic sector? And secondarily, what new initiatives do we need in terms of either global cooperation and or U.S.-China agreements with respect to cyber norms?
Big subject. Quick answer. Who wants to tackle it? Bonnie, maybe
I'll start and then let somebody else pick up. I think the background on this is that we did have an agreement during the Obama administration, which was, I think, one of the good successes of the Obama administration, that the Xi Jinping agreed with the United States that we should not be using cyber theft to engage in commercial advantage. And that was subsequently then extended to the G20. My understanding from things that I've read, people that I've spoken to, is that China is essentially abiding by this, but Michael's going to know more about this than I do.
Michael, quick answer. Let's get in.
Yeah,
about
just
2 minutes left.
Just very quickly. We know the Chinese are very active in targeting our government, U.S. industry, and those of our partners through cyber espionage. It's a very big problem, and we need to do more about it. Guess my point about an all-of-government, all-of-country approach to pushing back against it, yes.
That OPM hack feels like one of the great undercovered stories of the last couple of years. I promised, was it you, a question? I nodded at somebody. Go ahead. Doesn't matter. Quickly, please, and we'll see if we can do a quick answer and get one more after you.
Hi, Drew Danick from the University of Texas at Austin. In his book, The Paradox on World Powers, Stephen Hook suggested that the Nixon administration, in playing the China card at the height of the Cold War, kind of created a monster we couldn't really control. Can you speak to the accuracy of that statement? And looking forward, what do you think the game theory would look like were we to utilize that China relationship, China-Russia relationship, to promote American interests?
Well, I think there is always discussions about possible collaboration between Russia and China. That was the subject debated since the days of Cold War. But the conventional wisdom is they can never get married. It's a convenience, you know, friendship of convenience, and that is true. I think Russia feels some threat, geopolitical threat from China. But at the same time, you have to be aware of this tactical collaboration is always taking place to drive a wedge against the United States.
Yeah, 2 points quickly. I think there has an over-optimism that engagement with China would have led to political reform by this point. And the reforms that we perhaps may have expected from the Chinese by engaging would have we've started to see that, but now we haven't. On the Russia relationship, I know there's been a lot of talk about Russia, and we said earlier that it's important that we're talking about other issues, but I will suggest this. When you think about Russia's confidence internationally in the international system to be a problem for the United States, it very much helps Russia that China is also a problem for the United States. So even when we're just thinking about the Russia problem for the United States, I would submit that today it's very convenient and helpful for the Russians to be able to know that the Chinese also have a conflictual relationship with the United States that they can sort of back each other up.
Bonnie, we're in overtime, 15 seconds, and then we have to finish.
I think that the China-Russia relationship has gone beyond the marriage of convenience. There are shared interest in diminishing the influence of the United States. There are specific cooperations going on at the UN on North Korea and opposing FAD's deployment in South Korea. There's competition, areas like Central Asia. There's continuing mutual suspicion between China and Russia because of their histories. But they are working together to establish new norms in the international system. And I think that we really only downplay this at our own peril. So I think it's something we should be paying more attention to going forward.
Thank you all. We could have gone twice as long, in my opinion. Thank you all for your questions and for coming. Appreciate it very much.